Dear organizers, dear guests, dear participants, good afternoon from Oslo. My name is Kate Hansen-Bundt, and it's a pleasure and honor for me to open this webinar on NATO facing challenges from the Arctic to the Black Sea region. I was asked by the organizers to open the seminar in a double capacity. First, I'm the Secretary General of the Norwegian Atlantic Committee, an NGO that for many decades has been an important arena for debate and discussion on various aspects of international relations, security, and Norway's role as one of the founding members of NATO. Second, I'm also the head of the board at NUPI, the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, another Norwegian institution that plays a key part in the Norwegian debate on foreign and security policy. NUPI is at the same time partner in FLANKS. This webinar we are about to launch is organized by the two FLANKS partners, NUPI and the New Strategic Center in Bucharest, Romania. We'll be joined by the LSE IDs program at the London School of Economics. This event is just one in a series of events organized by the members of the FLANK project that has received the generous funding from the Norwegian-Romanian Bilateral Fund, a part of the so-called EEA grant scheme. FLANKS is a research project carried out in partnership between the New Strategic Center and NUPI between 2020 and 21. The main aim of this project is to produce new knowledge of security challenges in North and Southeast Europe, faced by Romania and Norway and by NATO and the European Union. More specific, this project examines the process of militarization of the Arctic region and the Black Sea region, with focus on Russian policies in both areas and their impact on regional security. We are pleased to see that the topics addressed by FLANKS are deemed relevant by other actors interested in these questions, and that LSE decided to join forces with the FLANKS team by providing us an arena for exchange of views on these highly policy relevant questions. NATO's eastern flank is an area where the alliance meets several challenges, in particular the challenge posed by Russia. The recently published Reflection Group study on NATO 2030 provides interesting details on how the situation in this region is preserved by experts across the alliance. It argues that the fact that Russia maintains a powerful conventional military and robust nuclear arsenal poses a threat across NATO territory, but that the situation is particularly acute on the eastern flank. However, Russia's continued strengthening of the northern fleet also poses a potential risk for Europe through long-range missiles, submarines, and its increased anti-access ability. Having this opinion in mind, it is encouraging to see that the FLANKS project can provide some interesting insights on these questions, and that those insights can be shared with a broader audience, even amidst of the COVID pandemic. A pandemic that has over the past 9 months tested our national and personal resilience. It is therefore my pleasure to present the key topics that we are going to address at this event and to open this arena for a hopefully interesting and constructive exchange of views on questions of crucial importance, not only for experts, but for the general public as well. As the program of this event clearly outlined, this exchange of views will center on three crucial aspects of security. The first panel today will examine NATO's many challenges in the context of the pandemic and discussed in the previously mentioned NATO 2030 report and elsewhere. In the second panel, we will turn our attention to the North to explore the security situation in the high North, where both economic climatic and military aspects of security will be discussed. Finally, in panel three, we will have a chance to get a better understanding of the security situation in the Black Sea region, another area where both NATO and the European Union meet Russia. Before giving the floor to Christopher Coker, Director of LSE ID's program, I would like to use this opportunity to thank all those who were involved in the organization of this event for making it possible. I wish you all an interesting and meaningful afternoon on the web. Goodbye from a dark Oslo.
Well, can I just reiterate what Kate has said? My name is Christopher Coker. I'm director of LSE Ideas, which is the chief foreign policy and security think tank at the London School of Economics. This is the second conference that we have co-hosted with the new Strategy Center in Bucharest. Our first was last December, which was actually looking at the future of NATO. This is the first, I stand to be corrected, since I've only been director for 2 years now, but I think this is the first conference that we've actually co-hosted with NUPI, and I hope it won't be the last. I think it's right that we should start with the COVID pandemic, because that has largely changed everything. But I think we're always in danger of speaking on being preoccupied too much, perhaps, with China, and forgetting that the main strategic threat to Europe, and indeed to NATO for the time being, is posed by Russia. There's a tendency to dismiss Russia as a declining power, and because China is an ascending one, to find China more interesting, and indeed perhaps in the long term more menacing than Russia. But Russia has been our chief strategic challenge since really 2005, and this is also to be found in the reflection group to which Kate has adhered. I mean, the Baltic states are lying with, in the shadow of reoccupation, perhaps one day, if it ever comes to the worst, the militarization of the Black Sea and the High North. The emergence, of course, of Turkey as a problematic power within NATO and outside. And of course, even though countries like Britain are perhaps far removed geographically from the eastern flank or the eastern Mediterranean, we have been the subject of grey zone activities, and the main grey zone country in this respect is Russia. So there's a great deal to discuss, and I look forward to a really challenging couple of hours. Might I therefore turn to Peter Watkins, who is the visiting senior fellow at LSE Ideas, who will be chairing the first panel. So Peter, over to you.
So good afternoon, everybody, from a grey and wet London, not quite dark yet. Though you might not think that from the rather fuzzy picture, but I'd like to welcome everybody to the first panel, which, as has been said by Christopher and by Kate, is on security challenges to NATO in the context of the pandemic. And as Christopher said, I am a visiting senior fellow with LSE Ideas, but also a former policy director with the British Ministry of Defence. So our panel has been given a very broad topic, which will, as has been set out, provide the wider framework for the two more geographically focused panels to follow. I mean, it says in the context of the pandemic, we're not planning to spend a huge amount of time on the pandemic in itself. When it told earlier in the year, there was no shortage of webinars on what strategic significance it had or didn't have. And I think the emerging conclusion of that welter of symposia and seminars and so on was that the most likely effect of the pandemic was to accelerate and accentuate geopolitical trends and geoeconomic trends that were already underway, including a shift in the global balance of economic and political power from west to east. But the timing of this event is actually extremely good in relation to the report that appeared only last week, which has been mentioned twice now, the NATO 2030 report by the Reflection Group, which was convened following last year's NATO summit in London. And that report highlights a number of challenges. It doesn't actually spend very much time on the pandemic at all. It's 67 pages long. I think there's a couple of pages on the pandemic. The challenges that it highlights, as Kate mentioned, the continuing disruptive and menacing behavior of Russia, the ambitions of China, which perhaps we'll come back to, the potential impact of emerging disruptive technologies, EDT, the latest NATO acronym, and yes, the potential impact of the pandemic on state budgets and thus defense spending over the medium term. So the pandemic is certainly a key contextual part of the discussion, but the other one, of course, is the advent of a new US administration in January of next year. So there's a lot there, and to help us get to grips with it, I am joined by a very distinguished panel. Their names are on the slide, but I will just briefly introduce them. First of all, Lieutenant General Daniel Petrescu, the Chief of Defence of Romania. General Sir James Everard, former Deputy Supreme Allied Commander Europe. And then Dr. Carsten Friis, Head of the Research Group on Security and Defence of NUPI, the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. So I'm going to ask each of them to speak for about 8 or 9 minutes. They've been given a pretty free choice of which parts of the menu they want to eat. And so they will speak in the order indicated. And then we'll then have a short panel discussion, and then I'll open up for questions and answers and any observations that you have. So I would just ask you now, if you wouldn't mind, to start thinking of your questions as our panelists start speaking, and to write them down in the Q&A function, which should be on the bar at the bottom of your screen, and they will then be fed to me. So without further ado, as they say, can I pass to you, General Petrescu, for your remarks?
Good evening from Bucharest, and thank you very much for your kind invitation, and thank you for having me here tonight. It is a pleasure for me to be able to attend in this panel, and also to be able to express some views on the security challenges for NATO in the context of the pandemic. And since the pandemic is the word of the day, I have to confess that I'm attending the conference from my office, where I have been isolated in the past 14 days after I tested positive for the virus. The good news is I am past the disease, so I got negative yesterday, and I'm ready to get back to normal life. But I could not have imagined a better way to finish my isolation, you know, than participating to this conference. If you see me looking at the door, this means I'm ready to get back to the normal life. Anyway, I would say that even if I had almost no symptoms during these weeks, testing positive, it's a serious psychological factor when you realize that the virus is not a joke. And I hope that all of you stay healthy, and with the opportunity to get vaccinated soon, we will defeat together this disease. Since I had 2 weeks to reflect on many things, I would start saying that we truly need to realize that we are living in a challenging period. And this is not only in terms of health crisis, but also in terms of security, economic, diplomatic, and informational implication. And I would give only the example of some events that happened in the world in the past 24 hours, just to realize how many things with strategic implication are happening as we speak. So these are some headlines I read this morning. Increased number of people infected and record number of deaths in some countries. Canada approving the vaccine while the UK is carrying out the vaccination campaign. A cyber attack happened at the European agency that is supposed to approve the vaccination. And this attack targeted the information related to the vaccine approval. Russia carried out a new strategic exercise testing their nuclear triad. And I expect highlights like this every day, because we seem to get in a period of time when serious things with massive implication in our lives are happening faster and faster. So the good part, because there is a good part also in everything that is happening, is that we have realized what is happening and we are seriously planning at the strategic level. There is a concurrent planning process at many levels, and I would mention here NATO with the reflection process, with the DDA, with the NATO strategy, EU with the European Union strategic compass, and you know, waiting for a new US administration strategic approach regarding the global challenges. I believe that this planning and resources and effort we will put in the implementation of the plans will influence our posture and our security for the next decade. So with this in mind, the issues I was planning to talk tonight was first, you know, some initial reaction to the report, NATO 2030, and second, the approach to the evolving challenges coming from Russia with some examples from the Black Sea region. And if time allows, I will give you some thoughts and predictions regarding the impact of the pandemic on the defense budget. So to start with, regarding the global security situation, I believe that NATO military strategy got the big picture very right, describing the strategic environment as being characterized by strategic competition, pervasive instability, and strategic shocks. There are strategic competitors for the West that create disorder, promote destabilization, and aim at acquiring decisive military advantage. And if I look from where I live here, we see an arch of instability and crisis surrounding Europe, where hybrid and asymmetric threats are combined and interconnected from the Arctic to the Black Sea and further on the Mediterranean. Pervasive instability is created by poor governance, weak economic development, climatic and demographic challenges, and violent extremism. And not in the end, we witness with increased frequency strategic shock. And these are economic crises, natural disasters, epidemics, mass terror attacks, and so on. So, and on top of that, the COVID-19 continues to manifest. And I believe this is a strategic shock with major impact on the global security environment. The perspective on of normality seems to be in sight, but in my view, it's still remote. This COVID impacted our military organization. It tested our strategic anticipation capability and also added challenges to our military posture. And this brings me to the report on the reflection group and its characterization of the challenges to NATO. And here I would join the ones that congratulate the reflection group for successfully fulfilling the mandate. Before getting into the details, I have some observation of the purpose and time horizon of the report, because I think we need to get it right before any discussion on the findings of the report. So this was an independent and forward-looking process and replies to the main question from the SecGen: find ways to strengthen the political dimension of the alliance. And I believe the report is focused on that only. It addresses the 2030 time horizon, which in my mind, it's already tomorrow. So I would say that the proposals of the report, I see them as immediate proposals. So, and I would also underline the main points, which I think they are very important during throughout the report. Our world is changing. A new decade of strategic rivalry is starting. Authoritarian states are carrying out an offensive while democracies are in defensive. The report provides me the opportunity to underline an inventory of offensive tools used by authoritarian states. And this is information manipulation, attempts to create like-minded satellite states, political coercion, challenges to representative democracy, built up and display offensive military capabilities, especially under the cover of the A2AD, hybrid tactics, aggressive pursuit for advantage in disruptive technology, threatening of energy security and critical infrastructure for the targeted countries, frozen conflict activation, weapons control regime violation, use of proxies and private military companies, offensive cyber and cyberspace technology, masks and vaccine diplomacy. And starting from the report findings, my view is that we should focus next on the following in the order of priority. First, consolidating NATO's role as a key Western organization. Second, a new strategic concept is needed to project the right strategic profile for the alliance in a highly contested world. Third, the centrality of the transatlantic bond and the commitment of all allies to NATO as the cornerstone of the Euro-Atlantic security. Fourth, I think we need a renewed approach to our partnership as a truly key element of political deterrence. And of course, here, I believe that the most important partner remains the EU, and NATO-EU should develop into a truly strategic partnership. Fifth, the importance of resilience, and I fully share it, and I believe that NATO could provide a framework to facilitate the national efforts and resilience. And not in the end, I would broadly appreciate the balanced and principled way Russia is reflected in the report. And I believe we should remain committed, as the report finds, to the current dual track approach. And with this, I would go with the second point regarding Russia. And it's written in report, and it's written also in the Romanian strategic planning documents, that the attitude and the action of the Russian Federation by neglecting the international law norms are generating opposition in NATO and represent serious obstacles in identifying viable solution for stability, predictability, and security. In our national planning documents, we consider that the increase of the military potential on the eastern flank, the militarization of Crimea and of the Black Sea region, carrying out military exercises, and the increase of the offensive capabilities in the region represent major challenges to our national security interests, with impact on the security of the NATO and EU eastern frontiers, and also with possible impact on energy security and stability in the Black Sea region. From a military perspective, in the area where I live, Moscow perceives a single track and acts on a single flank, well balanced in the northern and southern tiers. On both northeast and southeast of NATO, Russia does not care about using the minimum level of forces. On the contrary, it projects and uses with short to no notice an enhanced level of force deterrence. So this gradual consolidation of the military disposition of forces, the improvement of combat readiness and training, as well as the force projection capabilities, I think these are trends with significant operational impact in the Black Sea region and at the eastern flank, and I think we can talk about it later. And regarding the impact on the pandemics on the defense budget, maybe later, I see the direct impact with defense cuts, and I see also an indirect impact. It's the size of the GDP, which we expect with an economic crisis that could be caused the GDPs of the countries to decrease. And also we see public sensitivity over procurement programs, which could create challenges in implementing the endowment program. I will stop here. I hope I was in the time allowed, and I'm ready to answer the questions later. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Petrescu. Yes, you were just about in the time allowed. So I'll now move on, if I may, to General Everard, and he will give us a perspective, not least from his very recent role as the Deputy SACEUR. Over to you, James Everard.
Peter, thanks very much. I'm joining you from Ramstein today, where we're engaged in a non-Article 5 crisis response operation in support of the UN in North Africa, just to show that life goes on as normal. And actually, the military, I think, are getting much better at risk mitigation and getting away from risk avoidance, which I imagine that most of us are going to be doing next year. With this report as backdrop, I was given two hot topics. The concept of the deterrence and defence of the Euro-Atlantic area, DDA, and emerging and disruptive technologies, ED and T, both of importance to our flanks, both of importance to our national resilience. Let me start with ED and T, because the Reflection Group noted that these new technologies offer historic opportunities for strategic advantage. They make a number of recommendations that include anchoring these technologies in the NATO defence planning process. Actually, I think NATO has been slow here, but in their defence, it's very difficult to articulate the requirements that you are after. The group noted that the pace and focus, political focus on these technologies should increase so that we can counter threats and reap the fruits resulting from these innovations. And they also suggest the equivalent of a European Defence Fund charged with encouraging support for innovation. All interesting stuff. And in relation to China, they suggest that we develop a long-term plan, this is NATO, to counter China's military-civil fusion strategy in Europe and see that ED&T would have a role there. I also noticed in Thomas DeMazieu's recent briefing, he said that bytes and big data are just as important as bullets and battleships. And actually, this is what the UK integrated operating concept also hinted at. You know, it suggested there is going to be a time when ED&T lead to a new way of warfare, pervasive information gathering systems, constellations of satellites, making it very difficult for people to hide. I think we all love the idea of ED&T. You know, we can already do amazing things. It is the future. But I would caution, I think there's a significant gap between what has been shown to work at small scale and what is workable in time, over time, at scale, to deliver the impact and the effect that a commander or a government wants. You know, this is the gap between theory and reality. And the old hands will remember the debate between armour and anti-armour. I think the new debate is going to be between finding and blinding. And the same technology, I think, that allows you to find will in turn allow you to blind and hide. So yes, we need to invest in ED&T. It could be a great simplifier. It can be a great enabler. I can see AI delivering or helping to deliver information superiority. It can help overcome information saturation. And actually, even on this exercise, we've seen the benefit of AI in overcoming digital manipulation. So lots of promise. But the answer is a combination of all technologies, emerging and conventional, bridging over time as the latter is shown to work. So just as Thomas says that bytes and big data are as are important as bullets and battleships, so the reverse is true. On to DDA. And I think the DDA noted my words, that the military had stolen a march on the political, and that Thomas said in his verbal briefing this was, incorrect. And I think this is part true. You know, change was driven better bottom up by two saccers taking the initiative. I think they're part wrong, because while saccer strategic thoughts were kept on a narrow circulation, the ideas this paper contained were included in the NATO military strategy, comprehensive defence and shared response. And this, of course, was endorsed by the NAC in 2019. Likewise, you know, it was agreed that SACA would go away and produce a concept for the deterrence and defence of the Euro-Atlantic area. And again, this was endorsed by the NAC in early 2020. I think this is important. Also important to note that both these documents were designed really to look at the development and employment of the military alliance, the alliance's military instrument of power. But this said, I think they contain some big hooks which will change NATO's approach. You know, it recognised strategic competition, that was important. It recognised Russia and terrorism as threats, you know, given their strategic scale, given their depth, breadth, duration and complexity. And also they recognise the need to move away from crisis response to contest and counter these threats by developing a common capacity for competition and deterrence power in peacetime crisis and indeed defence. So yes, NATO remains a defensive alliance, of course it does, but all this work, NMS CDSR in particular, moves NATO psychologically away from a reactive to a proactive alliance with a deliberate strategy for force deployment and employment. And this is key to countering Russia on our flanks, Black Sea and the Arctic. DDA's in development, it hasn't been endorsed by the NAC yet, but in many ways, I think DDA, the genie's out the bottle. It is an approach to 21st century war fighting. There are innovative ideas on every one of its 50 or so pages. Nations on the whole like it, and nations are in large part already marching out on it. And I mentioned the fact earlier, UK integrated operating concept, you know, that is rooted in DDA. And next steps, I could easily see SACA issuing a strategic directive, you know, perhaps for baseline activities, current operations that will further embrace DDA as a methodology. Final point very quickly, evolution is important. We know this, you know, NATO has updated its strategic concept six times. And I think personally that the reflection group gives enough ammunition for our leaders to agree at the next summit to reframe the strategic concept. And I think this is important. Yes, some argue it opens up or could open up a Pandora's box, but I don't think we should be afraid to renew our wedding vows. And when you go back to the reflection group, you know, paper, it suggests the biggest challenge facing NATO is to consolidate the transatlantic link to ensure, I quote, that it possesses the tools, cohesion and consultative attributes to provide collective defence in a challenging landscape. And I think both a new strategic concept and indeed DDA is vital to that. I'll stop there.
Thank you very much indeed, James. Well, your final comment on the transatlantic link is the perfect and, of course, not contrived segue into Dr. Carsten Fries, who I think will want to make some observations about that, as well as one or two other things. So, Carsten, over to you.
Thank you, Peter. Yes, I will focus a little bit on the political level and what you mentioned earlier, the change of administration in the United States. So in Europe, we had this euphoria now over Biden, and everybody seems very happy. I heard Joseph Borrell recently jokingly say that we'll make multilateralism great again. So but the question is, what will this really mean for NATO, this change of administration? Well, I mean, first of all, words do matter. So President Trump's questioning of Article 5, it was not only once, but several times. It did create shockwaves in Europe. And it's not only symbolically, but it really weakened NATO significantly when it comes to the political cohesion. Because I think it's important to remember that NATO is a political alliance, not a legal one. And even if Article 5 sounds very legal, both the way it's formulated and the political realities that it's based upon, it's rest on political solidarity. So if you don't have that, this, you know, it doesn't matter what military assets you have available. So weakening of such a solidarity, it's not necessarily a crisis if you're talking about a small European state or even Turkey, but of course it's serious when it comes to the indispensable ally, the United States, because there is, as you all know, no NATO without the United States, both for political reasons and of course due to the military capacity that the United States has. So, I mean, a return to, let's say, traditional rhetorics from the White House is crucial, it's important. and that will kind of stabilize NATO again, so to speak. The only maybe positive side effect of Trump's way of expressing it himself is that the pressure on the 2% has been more effective, perhaps. But again, seen in isolation, but if in a larger context, it hasn't been very good for NATO. But on the other hand, if you look at the words aside and look at the real actions, I think it's also important to remind ourselves that US during the Trump administration has remained engaged in Europe. Actually, the European Deterrence Initiative was strengthened after Obama presidency. They continued with the EFP, the Enhanced Forward Presence in the Baltic States. They've been reestablished the Second Fleet in Virginia, which is responsible for the sea lines of communications, and also then co-located a new NATO Joint Force Command in Norfolk there. So it's a new structure in US soil. US Marine Corps continued its presence in Europe and even decreased their presence in Norway for a period. The administration also pulled out of the IMF, and I think any other administration would probably have done the same, because you kind of reach a threshold of patience with the Russian violation of the treaty. And then also military activity in our area, the northern part of in Arctic, we have had more air and maritime activity in the north from the US side. Now, of course, we had more recent drawdown decision in Germany and reorganization of the troops in Europe and as a negative activity, so to speak, and also Trump's refusal to confront Russia on the highest level. Of course, it's pulling out the Iran deal and other things has had negative implications for NATO. Most importantly, of course, he has increased the pressure on China. So what will change then of all these things here? Well, I think China and Asia will be the most important also for Biden. We remember the Trump administration's national security strategy when it came out. It kind of was a symbolic change away from the war on terror into a geopolitical rivalry with a focus on Russia and China. And I wouldn't be surprised if Biden's strategy will actually elevate China as a top major challenge for the United States. And Russia will remain there as a military challenge, but more as a disruptive force than a global rival. Now, this focus on China, well, if security is a zero-sum game, that's bad news for Europe and NATO. But it's not. The US do have resources and capacity to stay engaged politically and militarily in several theaters, at least if you avoid, you know, a significant escalation. I don't think the US can fight the war in more than one theater at the time anymore. But it will require that NATO and Europe is remain relevant for the US when it comes to China. And of course, we saw the London statement last year, and recently we saw Secretary General Stoltenberg clearly, you know, restating the language on China. I will quote him here just to remind you what he was said. He said that China is investigating heavily in modern military capabilities, including missiles that can reach all NATO allied countries. They're coming closer to us in cyberspace. We see them in the Arctic, in Africa. We see them investing in our critical infrastructure, and they are working more and more together with Russia. All of this has security consequences for NATO allies. Therefore, we need to be able to respond to that, to address that. But we need to do that by forging NATO as a stronger political alliance. The first step in this regard is to strengthen the partnership with the Asia-Pacific countries, Australia, Japan, South Korea, and New Zealand. But of course, this has to be followed up with something more concrete. And Biden, let's remember that he might be the last, let's say, European-American president. He's a child of the Cold War. But as demographic change and focus change, we cannot expect to have those kind of presidents anymore. We have a kind of a transatlantic gene in them, so to speak. And who knows who will come and replace him in 4 to 8 years. It might be a new shape of Trump. So Asia will remain important. And I don't think Biden will engage more in the Middle East and Northern Africa than Trump either. I mean, if you remember he was opposing the Afghanistan surge at the time when he was vice president. And he was arguing for a more limited counterterrorism campaign there. So he'll probably continue such a careful line. So that means that Europe must take care of the day-to-day security in and around Europe. And that brings me to the Europe and a few words on NATO and the European Union. And because the Secretary General Stoltenberg and High Representative Mogherini begun a very important process, and a NATO 2030 has, you know, more ideas, and they should facilitate more in this regard. And the European Union has done a lot recently. The budget is about to be passed as €8 billion for European Defence Fund, which is significant, the very first time that EU spend money on defence. But this and PESCO and other initiatives are positive. But this is about force production, not force projection, right? So it's about industrial streamlining, about reducing the number of platforms. So the results are years or maybe decades away. So, you know, European strategic autonomy is not, you know, around the corner. It's not here tomorrow. And even if there are some other initiatives like the Joint Expeditionary Force and EI2 and things like that, these are limited. And Europe is still unable to conduct a larger conventional military operation over time without US support. So in the long run, I think it's obvious that European, NATO and EU will be tight. I mean, the cooperation will be tight and EU will become a more important security actor. But in the short term, the question is what Europe, European Union or European NATO can offer Biden and other American Atlanticists, which represent a significant and sustainable reinforcement of the transatlantic security relations. That is more uncertain, but I think it's a very key question to answer. And I don't have the answer to that yet, but I think it's very important to find out within a couple of years. That's the time window we have. Thank you, I will stop there.
Thank you very much, Carsten, for that. And I'm gonna follow up actually with what you've just said. But first of all, I would just like to thank everybody who's been putting questions into the Q&A function. We have plenty to be getting our teeth into. And therefore, I'm going to keep this panel discussion quite short. But just to pick up on two things, one that Christopher said at the beginning and what Carsten has just said. You know, when we're looking at Russia and China, we do have to keep things in perspective. And as Christopher said, there's a slight tendency by certain governments, including possibly the British one at the moment, to rather over-focus on, you know, the rising challenge rather than the one that's already there. So you have that. And then you've got Carsten's point that China will be as important for Joe Biden as it was for Trump. Perhaps it'll be expressed in a different way, and NATO has to remain relevant to US's security concerns. So I just wondered whether our two generals had any immediate thoughts as to how we reconcile this. How does NATO keep its focus on those two things without doing too little on both of them? You know, how does any sort of, as Carsten says, it'll take a while to work this through, but any initial thoughts you have about this new balancing act that NATO will have to undertake?
Thank you, Peter. If I may, I would start, you know, when we learn about strategic planning, you know, we learned there are two ways to do that strategic planning and build your capabilities. First, the threat-informed planning, and second, the capability-based planning. I think, this is very well, you know, underlined in the report. Threats are an issue, but also the way we prioritize these threats is an issue. And we have these two strategic rivals you mentioned. We have the enduring threat of terrorism. We have the threat of the southern instability. We have a dramatically changing technology environment. And we have a man-made and, you know, always a danger of natural disaster. I would think, and the approach I would take is, build your own capabilities, you know, necessary to deal with all these challenges and keep the strategic unity, you know, as a center of gravity for your alliance. And have plans, you know, well rehearsed during the exercises, how you deal with each of them. It's always a matter of strategy, but it's always a matter of the ways and the means you have available. And I would emphasize the need to build the necessary means in order to deal with that.
Thank you very much. James, do you have a thought?
I'll stick with the same theme that Daniel has kicked off, which is, you know, NATO, it's actually pretty good at planning. It's pretty terrible at resourcing those plans. And we have a problem that our, you know, demand and supply is out of balance. And when it comes to NATO's missions, activities and operations, regardless what the focus is, we're good at starting them, but we're terrible at ending them. And so I think NATO is going to have to be more ruthless with itself. More surgical operations, better clarity on end states, and a clearer and I think more realistic vision of what can be achieved with the military instrument of power. Is that all right?
Yeah, that's great. We've got about half an hour, just a bit over half an hour. As I said, we've had a lot of questions. So I'm going to start picking up the questions now. If we do run out, then I've got a few up my sleeve that I can return to the panelists with. So don't think you'll, get off lightly. So I've had two questions that were two of the first questions to be posed about Moldova. And the first was from Stephen Danner and the second from Ewan Grant. And Stephen asks, and this is particularly aimed at you, General Petrescu, with the recent election of President Sandu in Moldova and her demand that Russian troops depart Moldova, is Romania concerned about an increase of Russian intervention, he puts it, or activity in that country? And then the related question, which is from Ewan Grant, as I said, is how is NATO engaging in the Black Sea with the EU European External Action Service, and what opportunities are there to support Moldova? So perhaps, General Petrescu, you could pick up the first one and give us a view from Bucharest on that. And perhaps, Carsten, you might just reflect on the question about NATO-EU engagement in the Black Sea. And if you can't questions, then of course our third panel can return to this subject as necessary. So over to you, Jeff Petrescu.
Okay, I got the first part of the question. How do we see the evolution in Moldova, and if we are concerned that Russia could intervene or could, try to interfere more with what is going on into Moldova? Because the rest, you came a little bit interruptly.
Yeah.
I mentioned earlier, the strategic planning documents we have in Romania, and this year, we came out with a new national security strategy for the 2020 and 2024. And in that national security strategy, it's very well written that we follow very closely what is going on in Moldova. And we see a risk if Moldova, drifts more towards east than it goes towards west. And we see the way for Moldova is with the West and in the European Union. And we believe also that these are the aspirations of the people from Moldova. I think the election of Maia Sandu should be welcome. And I believe this is only a battle, in the long challenge of getting Moldova closer to the European Union and closer to the West. We see some other political parties and the former president that, still have influence in parliament. And you noticed, from the open sources, what they try to do with the intelligence services and so on. But I believe in the end, what the people express their options will prevail. And I believe Moldova will find its way towards Western values and Western principles.
Good. And Carsten, can you pick up the NATO-EU point?
Well, unfortunately, I'm not the best to answer that when it comes to the Black Sea region. So I either suggest about General Petrescu answer that as well, or refer it to the third panel where we have Black Sea experts.
Okay, well, I'm happy to refer it to the third panel. So I think that's part of the purpose of the way that we're organized is that we're doing a general panel so we can pick things up and pass them on as we see fit, which is a good thing. Now, I've had, again, I'm trying to bunch the questions so that we don't repeat ourselves too much. So I've had a couple of questions about Turkey. In fact, I've had three questions, and I will bunch them, if I may. The first one is from Reed, which is, does the panel see its continued membership of NATO as a security threat to the organization, considering its purchase of Russian military hardware and therefore the possible transfer of Western military technology in the other direction? And then Lazar Orel has asked, and I think this is a genuine question and not just a rhetorical one, does the panel believe that Turkey will activate the S-400 system, or is it basically a game to persuade NATO to send the Patriot system to Ankara? And then Katerina from Greece asked a sort of, I think, a related question about that interrelationship between, you know, hardware and geopolitics in relation to Turkey. So if I could just turn back to the panel. James, as the Deputy Secure, you will have been following this saga for a long time. I remember when I was doing my role at the Ministry of Defence, so this is back in 2018, this topic of the S-400 purchase was a regular in the margins of NATO ministerials. So any thoughts from you, and then I'll pass back to the other two panellists.
I think it's pretty simple. A, I mean, Turkey isn't the only country to buy, not the only alliance country to own Russian equipment. But in the case of the missile system, which is highly effective, I think they will activate it, but it won't be activated inside the NATO integrated air defence system. And therefore, its potency for Turkey is hugely decreased. And you're right, I think perhaps behind this is a bit of a power play going on. And with hindsight, if the US had offered a better deal on Patriot missiles earlier on, perhaps we wouldn't be in this case. But it will not be integrated, it will not be activated inside the NATO system. It can't be.
Okay. General Petrescu, any views? Daniel?
From my point of view, you know, we are very close allies and friends in this area. And everything what is going on in the area, you know, in the Black Sea region, it's also affecting Romania and it's also affecting Turkey. And expressing this great relationship we have in Turkey, I have to underline that Turkey, it's a great contributor to the, you know, allied initiatives in Romania, like multinational division Southeast, like the new core. You know, with the NRF next year, they will participate to the exercise in Romania. So with this in mind, you know, I would say that the decision to buy S-400 was a political decision. And this really needs to be explained at the political level. Regarding the will to activate or not, purely from a military point of view, it doesn't make sense to buy a system without activating it. But I wouldn't jump into conclusion to say when will be activated and how it will be activated. And I will stop here, you know, speaking in my uniform regarding what is going on there.
Yeah. And Carsten, any observations from your
Yeah, I mean, let's remember that Turkey has always been, I don't know the perfect term, but somewhat a difficult child in within NATO family for a long time. And remember, many of us have actually granted asylum to military officers from Turkey, you know, from an allied country. So, I mean, that is rather unusual. And so Turkey is too important to be abandoned. We have a flank country and a huge military power. Skillfully, politically, that's being exploited, I think, they will not be, you know, kicked out anyhow like that. So they're playing this game. I'm not a Turkey expert, so I'll not go into the details about the politics at play here. But there's a certain element of divide and rule, I think, to your own benefits.
Thank you very much. And there's a follow-up question from Turkey, which I'd like to ask you. And it's from Ismail Akhmadov. And I think it's picking up this point that both you, Daniel, and Carsten have made, that there might be a positive aspect to this. And Ishmael's question is, the Turkish military will now be working together with Russian peacekeepers in the Joint Monitoring Center to control the ceasefire in Nagorno-Karabakh. And this sort of means a presence of NATO. And do you basically, and I'll slightly rephrase his question, but do you see any opportunities here for us to use that relationship between NATO, between Turkey and Russia, to contain Russian misbehavior against some of its neighbors? So is there a plus here perhaps we're missing when we talk about some of the technological issues around the S-400? Any views?
I can start if you like. I mean, I think in general, tactical level interaction between military forces is positive in a good way. I mean, it is, you know, it creates some bottom-up confidence building. We'll learn each other to know. I mean, so that is fine, and we should have, you know, communications on all levels. But of course, you reach at some stage a political level where, you know, you cannot achieve that much because of the different political interests. So yes, I think it could be, you know, have some positive spillover, but you shouldn't be kind of, I don't think the relations between Russia and NATO will resolve the bottom up, to put it that way.
Yeah.
If I may, I would agree this. I think, you know, cooperating tactically on the field will never influence what is going on at the strategic level. The presence of peacekeeper, again, it's a political decision. And military, you know, just following that political decision, and they are doing their job on the field. But this will not solve the issue with dealing with Russia. And dealing with Russia is that dual track approach, which we also sustain. And this has to be done at the strategic level, not at the tactical level, in my mind. And you cannot go further with this cooperation until the big issues like, you know, illegal annexation of Crimea, supporting what is going on in Donbas, and all the other militarization of the Black Sea region, and all the other action, you know, Russians are doing, you know, this cannot be solved at the tactical level, in my mind.
Great. James, do you want to add anything?
Well, I need to make the obvious point that the presence of Turkish troops doesn't make it a NATO operation. Nations are very capable to keep them separate. But I agree with Daniel, it's a strategic issue and it needs to be unpicked at the highest level.
Right. Thank you for that. Well, there you are, Ishmael. You got your answer, I think. Very clear. So I'd now like to broaden the aperture a bit and pick up a question from one of our colleagues at the New Strategy Center, from Doru Costilla. Sorry if I mispronounced that. And he observes, the NATO 2030 report highlights, and this is a question, the South will likely grow in importance for NATO, unquote, and recognizes that NATO should engage more partners in the area. I think the report also says, because I quoted this at somebody earlier today, that NATO needs a clearer more consistent and more coherent approach to the South. So it's one of the big issues that's raised in that report, and personally, I think rightly. So I just wondered whether I could ask each of you actually just to sort of, as I said, broaden the aperture a bit, give us your views on how you think NATO should take that bigger approach to the South. And in particular, and this is picking up Doru's question, consider the ways in which NATO might increase its engagement with partners, first point. And secondly, and this, should we look at sub-regional security arrangements? Or thirdly, focus on bilateral approach? So there's quite a lot there. And it's a big subject, so do feel free to develop your thoughts at a bit of length, because we have got time. So where do I start? I think James, you're nodding your head, so I'm going to come to you first.
It's such an important subject, because I think a focus on the South is important for alliance, solidarity and cohesion. But my concern, Peter, is the Southern nations have said it, they then shouted it loudly. But the reality is, at the moment, no one has been able to articulate exactly what it is they want NATO to do that is within the bounds of achievability, or is not already being done by nations bilaterally with those nations. And so capacity building, projecting stability, all these things are possible. But what one needs is a clear definition of the requirement, and then we might get somewhere. But at the moment, in my 3 years in NATO, despite endless efforts, no one has actually come up with a firm plan.
If I may, I believe there are two areas here that interfere. First is working with partners, and second is what we do for the South. And I think both of them are very well reflected in the recommendations of the report. So the report speaks about the Southern instability and what NATO should do. And the report also speaks about partners. And I remember, at least in the past, you know, 5 or 6 years, NATO has tried a lot to reach out to partners, you know, with enhanced partnership programs and so on. We saw the hub for the South, you know, being established in NATO, in Naples, and becoming fully operational capable. And we see all this 360 degrees approach, which means not only the big challengers, you know, the Russian challenge and the Eastern flank, but also what we do in the South. In terms of partners, we also recognize the importance in the Black Sea region. And we want to see NATO working more with Moldova, with Ukraine, with Georgia. And we do this, we get involved into this, both under NATO or on bilateral approaches. Regarding the South, this is also probably something we can discuss when we speak about NATO-EU cooperation, because I think this is also a place where this partnership with the EU could get us to some solutions and some conclusions what we do there.
Okay, Carsten, perhaps you'd like to come out in, particularly picking up that point from Daniel.
Yes, I mean, the South, as James also said, I mean, they've been asking for a long time, what can NATO contribute? And what is NATO's role in the South? And then we have to, okay, what is the South? What is the challenge we're facing from the South? Well, one of them is migration. And you know, with climate change and other things happening, you know, lots of predictions that this is going to increase a lot. Well, you know, the tools that NATO has is not very relevant for migration. So okay, then we have radical movements in Sahel, and so of course NATO and like France is doing now can play a role there, and also in security force training of the countries there. But there are limits to what NATO can do, as you know, when it comes to the different challenges stemming from the South. So, It is about finding a clear role, so to speak, and it has to focus on the kind of hard security end. Of course, seeing Russian troops engaging more and more in Libya illustrates that it is important to be engaged also on the kind of hard security side. But again, as General Petrescu said, you need to do this in concert with the European Union and other actors, I think, because the complexity of challenges are broader than the military one.
Yeah. But it's also
I would add something, if I may, because, Carton said that we cannot do much. I mean, if we look, only at putting boots on the ground, or trying some forms of cooperation, as you said, bilateral or multilateral, yes, maybe we can think about it. But the first thing is to know the situation and to have the situational awareness. And I think this is what we are doing with the hub for the South. And reaching out to the countries, there. And also this is something what we are doing with the Hub for the South. So we cannot say that we are doing nothing. I think we should focus more, and getting a better situation awareness for the beginning.
Okay, thank you very much. And I'm glad that, Carsten, you brought out the importance of the southern littoral, because that area has been unstable now for, the best part of 10 years with significant implications for Europe. I've had a couple of questions which are quite specifically related to Romania, which I'll put to you, General Petrescu, but I do recognize that you might not feel it's entirely appropriate for you as a serving military officer to answer them, and in which case we will move on. But I think they may not be entirely inappropriate. So both refer to the Romanian general election. One from Laurentiu Paju asks, do you think it is likely that the new government following the elections will start reforming the Romanian defense industry? So you may or may not wish to comment on that. The other question, which is from Serena Stallard, is whether post the elections, more should be done in Romania around risk mitigation and avoidance in the areas of extremism and fake news, which I presume must have been an issue in the election, and whether you think there's anything that NATO could do to help in that regard. So if I could pass you those, but I do understand if you don't think they're entirely appropriate. And while you're answering, I could just mention to our participants that there is still time for you to put in a couple more questions if you wish to do so. So over to you, General.
Thank you very much. So the first question regarding the Romanian defense industry. First, speaking about election, I have to report that I voted. I requested the guys to come here. They came in the isolation, so I voted. So I brought my contribution as a citizen to this process. As a military, Romanian defense industry, as the people who asked the question know, they are not under the Minister of Defense. They are under a Minister of Economy. But this doesn't mean we are not cooperating with the Minister of Economy, and it doesn't mean we are not very interested in what is going on with the defense industry. We are working on the national military strategy now, and we also published the white book on defense. And both of them recognize the need to have a national defense industry to support our capabilities. Also, we are carrying out a very ambitious procurement program. And part of that procurement program is to make sure that a part of the investment we make into the new equipment and new capabilities is returning into the defense industry and is creating jobs. Unfortunately, for a very long period of time, defense industry was neglected. And we started to invest, I mean, even us, the military, to have more contact, you know, and put more money into defense industry only after 2017, 2018, when we started to receive 2% from GDP for defense. So we are very much aware regarding this. We are pushing very much the relationship with the Minister of Economy into that. This year, I think together with the Minister of Defense, we traveled into, you know, units from the defense industry, probably more than we traveled into military units, in order to know exactly what is happening on the ground and to find ways to contribute with this defense industry. What the new government will do, I don't know so far, but we are trying to influence with the military strategy, with the white paper on defense, you know, to make sure that everybody knows that national defense industry it's important. Second, risk mitigation regarding extremism and fake news. The national security strategy also mentioned, you know, the danger of fake news, the danger of disinformation, and even in the paper we discussed at the beginning, I think it very clearly, you know, among the instruments, you know, the challengers are using, they speak about disinformation and fake news. And we noticed this very much during the pandemics. I think the pandemic really much exacerbated what was going on with the information of the population. And probably we are going to see it very much during the vaccination campaign we will start it. So we are aware of this. I think one way is to improve the level of education. The second one is, you know, to communicate more with the people and to explain more. The third one, because we speak about the national security, is to improve what we think about a culture of security, you know, with every person, with every citizen, with every individual, to understand the role of the fake news, to develop the critical thinking. You know, what we did in the Ministry of Defense, we established a site, you know, where we fight the fake news. We found articles, fake news, and we try to dismantle and to explain what is going on. I've noticed that the press started, you know, to access our site, you know, and to get informed and to, you know, inform the other population. So this helped a little bit, but it's a long process and it's very difficult to fight with this fake news.
Yeah, no, I agree, General. It is indeed. You know, this is this stuff can be generated at an extraordinary pace, as we have been seeing in the United States recently, and without sort of scruple in terms of some of the claims that are made. I just wondered, before we move on to our final few questions, Carsten, do you want to comment on that from a Nordic perspective, if I may, given that Norway and your neighbours have perhaps invested more than many in trying to address this aspect, if you like, of hybrid warfare, the sort of disinformation angle?
Yes, it is an interesting difference between the Nordic countries, actually, when it comes to being exposed to this fake news from Russia in particular. So from the Norwegian side, we're exposed to, let's say, traditional hacking. As late of yesterday, our security service went out publicly and gave more information about the recent hack against our parliament, which was publicly attributed to Russia. But when it comes to the information campaign and misinformation campaigns, we are not that exposed. But Sweden has on the other hand, experienced much more attempts at stirring up tensions or divide and rule, or whatever you want to call it. To influence the political climate. And of course, I guess from a Russian point of view, it's strategically important to try to avoid anything moving towards NATO. And that the same applies to Finland. But in particular, Sweden has been exposed to this more than Finland and more than Norway, maybe because the population is more split. So it's easier to utilize that or exploit it for fake news. So there's a difference there. other than that, we when it comes to hybrid warfare in general, we that's something everybody talks about and we plan for and we think about the gray zone situations. That does mean we have experienced it a lot, but of course it's an awareness about security. It's a much broader concept than it used to be. It was way beyond the defense sector, of course.
No, thank you. And I'd like to stick on this theme of resilience that we've got into. And we have at least one question, which I do feel, I mean, it's a good question, but I feel obliged to take it because it does address the pandemic directly. And this is from Lou Coatney, who asks whether the panel believe that the pandemic and our handling of it has offered any lessons in civil defense, which would be relevant for dealing with biological warfare threats. I mean, we know that certain countries have capabilities which they probably shouldn't have. So is there any read across there from, if you like, the health crisis to that more focused sort of biological or even chemical warfare crisis that we might face? Any views on that? Carsten, you're nodding your head, perhaps you could kick off.
Yeah, obviously there are. I mean, it's about civil preparedness, both at a national level and European level. And, you know, having a certain number of stocks stocked up on certain criteria, key medicine is, you know, I think most countries will do that now to kind of reassess medical supplies, protection gear, you know, procurement, preparedness in general, the whole national preparedness plan when it comes to these kind of threats. And secondly, there will be a more European cooperation. We're already seeing that. We don't all need to have our own stocks on everything. We can have all the European solutions on this. So I think that this is one of the side effects, that you get more integration in the health security sector than you had before. It wasn't that EU competence, it's becoming one. So you will have that both on the national and the European level. So obviously lessons learned here, I think.
No.
I think there are definitely lessons learned. And I would go a little bit more at the strategic level, you know, what this pandemic taught us and what we should do. And first, it taught us that strategic shock happened and you can get surprised by this strategic shock. It also showed us that when they happen, you need a very strong leadership and you need capabilities and you need stocks. First, everything is very fuzzy. It's like the fog of war, you know, very difficult to distinguish and predict what is going on to happen. And there is a tendency everywhere, countries, they get very much inward oriented and they try to solve the problem, you know, internally with what they have. But now, after so many months in the pandemics, I think we really have learned that we should go multilateral, that we should go under NATO and the EU, and we really can get the support, and it's better to work together. You discover that you cannot isolate. Remember at the beginning of the pandemic when there was a tendency to close the border, to stop the transportation, and we very, you know, very fast realized that we cannot do that.
And
one more thing. We also realized that there are very great expectations from the people, you know, to the state and all the institutions to get involved. Thank you. Sorry.
Yeah. James.
I was just going to add, well, Daniel very cleverly called it a lesson learned. I think probably it's probably lessons identified, and we'll see whether they're learned over time. But what I do think is good coming out of the pandemic is the word contingency had become a bad word. People didn't want to resource contingency. They were very pro the just-in-time approach to logistics. And I think we've been bitten by this. And although it's going to be expensive, I think you will see nations now treating contingency with the respect it deserves and investing in the capabilities that you need in advance. Otherwise, we'll be bitten again.
Thank you very much. So we've got a few more minutes left, and I've got a few more interesting questions. And we spent some time earlier talking about the South and the Black Sea and so on. And I've had a question from Georgia Magaru from the New Strategy Centre, who asked whether the panel might say something about the Balkans. Perhaps hasn't been getting quite as much attention as it used to, but in a number of countries, you know, whether Montenegro, Serbia, etc., there are, you know, things happening. So who would like to comment on the Balkans? Carsten.
I spent 10 years of my life there, so I guess I can stop. I don't know where to stop because it's a very broad question. Say something about the Balkans. So So let's look at the larger picture of stability and you know, in the region and from a security perspective. I mean, we haven't had war there since you know, for a long time. So we know on the surface of it, it's a success story. But of course, we have kind of frozen conflicts. Both in Bosnia in particular and in Kosovo as well. So the questions, some of the main questions that caused the war are not resolved and actually getting entrenched and more difficult to resolve as the years go by, particularly in Bosnia, where new generations grow up and never actually lived in a you know, with the other ethnic groups in Yugoslavia. So, you know, there are challenges, and you add to that, you know, the economic growth is still not back to pre-war level. The economic level, huge brain drain, and of course political corruption, and the political system is a very patriarchal, so that, you know, it's very corrupt in many places. So you know, that's a kind of bleak picture. And then you have, of course, the positive things. There are countries are moving towards NATO, towards EU. Montenegro had for the first time actually a democratic change of government ever, you know, the other day, a few days ago. So you know, democracy is slowly progressing, but on the other hand, you can say it's also regressing. Like in Serbia, it's become more authoritarian and less democratic. So it's a mixed picture. But depending on the perspective you take, they're far away from becoming stable European countries that contribute to European security. Many of these countries. But on the other hand, there's no war, and there are with the right support, I think much more could have been achieved. I will leave it at that.
Great. Generals, do you want to add?
From my point of view, oh, sorry.
From
my point of view, we follow very carefully what is going on in the Balkans. First, because it is important for us, it's very close to our area. And second, because we believe that what is going on in the Balkans also has implication on the European security. I would say that the main point would be to stay involved there and try to contribute and support. And Romania is participating to the NATO operation in Kosovo and also to European Union operation in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Probably the solution should be found first at the political level. But this is only the first step. And we know from the transition period we had in this area that, you know, political process will influence everything, but it's only the first step into this. But I believe the people in the Balkans, they really need a way out, you know, from that situation. And probably the path to the NATO and the EU could be a way out for them and, you know, a way to a better security situation.
James,
Peter. Well, just quickly, I mean, you don't go to a briefing of the European Policy and Security Committee without being told that the Balkans are stable but fragile, which is a contradiction in terms. And it's been the same for a long time, you know, with a political class that sees no advantage in change, hemorrhaging people, as we've heard. And I thought the NSC hosted a very good webinar some months ago on the strategic competition that is very evident in the Balkans. And so I worry about the Balkans because by the time we get round to resolving it, I worry how many good people will be left.
Good. Thank you very much. Now we've got 5 minutes left. I've got one question that I would like just to ask the two generals. And quick question, quick responses, please, and then I will sum up. So the question is from Ian Anthony of CIPRI, who observes that the money applied to military mobility in the next EU budget, the amount of money is disappointing. So he asks, are the plans, and you both have a view on this, are the plans to facilitate military mobility in Europe now at risk? Quick answers, quick, please, and then I'll wrap up. You, General Petrescu, first.
I would say that I'm not particularly happy with the amount of money provided to this military mobility. And I asked that question, you know, Joseph Borrell, when we had I had the opportunity, because I consider this was a strategic program. This was something very important for the NATO-EU cooperation, you know, a very and a flagship program for many European countries. But money is what it is. This is what we will have to spend for the next period. We will also have to, you know, focus our own efforts, you know, in developing the mobility projects. And I'm speaking for Romania on our territory, and our MOD is cooperating with the Minister of Transportation, trying to find ways, you know, to accommodate this military and to improve the military mobility throughout Romania.
Thanks. And James?
I'd say Allied Command Operations have made huge progress on the enablement of the AOR and deployment plans. But it is also inefficient because it should have been the best example of EU-NATO cooperation and it has failed to deliver as we had hoped.
Right. Thank you very much for two very crisp answers, which gives me precisely 2 minutes to wrap up. So first of all, I would like to thank our panellists for their concise and trenchant observations. I'd also like to thank our participants, our audience, for a very large number of questions. And I'm sorry I couldn't get to all of them. As you notice, I did deliberately bunch some to try and get through them. And if I didn't pick up on your question, it doesn't mean that I was trying to censor you or anything. It was simply there is you know, a limit to how much one can cover. But in terms of wrapping up, I think there's a couple of themes that I would draw out. I mean, one is, as General Petrescu said, the pandemic has undoubtedly been a strategic shock. And the chances are, and I think this was alluded to by our introductory speakers, there's going to be more of them. They seem to be increasing in frequency in one way or another, whether it's a pandemic or an economic issue or whatever. But we have learned some good lessons from this, you know, whether in terms of national resilience, in terms of communications, in terms of thinking about our supply chains and so on. And those are lessons that we need to make sure that we don't just identify, as James said, but we actually learn. That's an important point. I think the second issue that's come through very clearly, and it may seem a little odd perhaps for a Brit to highlight this, is the importance of the institutional cooperation between NATO and the EU. Many of the challenges that we face can only be addressed by those two organizations working very closely together. Whether dealing with migration or the technological challenge from China and so on. And I think the third one, which is my segue to the next two panels, and it's been interesting how pretty much all of our questions have related to NATO's flanks in one way or another, whether it's the north or the east, or the south. The western flank seems to be reasonably secure at the moment. Let's hope it stays that way. But, you know, those the boundaries, the borders, the flanks are, of course, the key areas where crises and challenges can develop. So I think that's a good place to for us to move from discussing the general excuse the pun, but general concerns, and then to hand on to the next two panels. And I think there will now be a short 4 or 5 minute break. But thank you very much,
thanks, Peter.
Panelists, and thank you for the participants.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.